Hi, this is Dr. Eric Westman, and welcome back. It's my great pleasure to be interviewing Dr. Gary Fetke. Dr. Fetke has been talking about low-carb diets, keto diets, for a long time. Welcome to the program.
Eric, just fabulous to catch up once again.
Great to see you and chat. And I miss those days, by the way, when we could, you know, share a coffee or chatting, you know, off the record, you know, but and maybe we'll get off the record a little bit with this. But
well,
how did
I mean? I miss your I miss your singing because I'm tone deaf, and you can serenade. So I don't know how many of your the people listening know that how good your vocal repertoire
Oh, that's
is.
funny. You know, we tried using some songs in the social media, and they find out they clamp down and don't allow it because of copyrights. So that is not something I do on social media. But if people do travel to my office at Duke, we celebrate by having a song, and people choose the song, their favorite song, and we play it. There happens to be a piano out in the waiting room. So it's funny you mentioned that. Back to, you know, low carb and keto. How did you get involved with this? You're a surgeon.
Well, I can't not mention that Belinda's actually done the low-carb anthem of this. She's actually put it to words. So the low-carb anthem, you look it up on YouTube, it's Belinda Fetke, the low-carb anthem. So it was the end of a conference, but effectively it talks about all the bit. She sings it, but it's to the, we haven't been caught up by, it's to the tune of Mary Poppins, a supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And so that's, and she's got a voice, and you too have. How did I get into low carb? Look, I think like many, I mean, not I know your story, but mine was my own personal story. So it's quite a selfish one. So I, in retrospect, so a lot of things in retrospect, you know, how many things we got wrong, we've apologized to our children. Sorry, guys, we brought you up the wrong way, but they're on track now. So I was, you know, I was a fat kid. But in again, if you look at today's children, I wasn't. But at the time, when you look at the old school swimming photographs, I was overweight. I was a good swimmer, good sport, but my mum had me on diets when I was, you know, 10. I can still remember the Israeli diet, which was, you know, eating apples all day. You know, but I so she was trying to get my weight under control. I wasn't hugely fat, but I was just overweight by today's standards, and I took that all the way through life. So. Again, in retrospect, if I go back 15 years, I was obese. I was 40 odd pounds heavier than where I am now. I did have high blood pressure. I was pre-diabetic. My waist circumference was up, you know, and I was trying to do the right thing by myself, which was, I thought, okay, I need to, you know, I'm going to eat by the food pyramid now, and it didn't work, you know, so I'm just going to exercise more And sure, I'd have a bit of chocolate here, but, you know, I was actually eating pretty well by the food pyramid and putting on weight. And I've got a term, I think you may have heard it, where I say, look, if you eat by the food pyramid, you're going to die by the food pyramid. And along the way, you're going to look like the food pyramid. It, you know, yeah. It's that triangular shape. And, you know, without being judgmental, yeah. But we all make observations in society. And when you go to the shops,
But you're in Australia. And yet you're affected by the U.S. food pyramid.
How many rabbit burrows are we going to go down today? So the U.S. food pyramid is literally, it is everywhere. And, that's the history of, I'll come back to how I kept going. So effectively, I then had a tumor at the base of my brain 24 years ago now. And I was eating badly. I was on chemotherapy. I was trying to do the right thing. Nothing was working. And then I heard about metformin in the management of cancer, which was really new stuff 14, 15 years ago. And that if people that had aggressive cancers did better if they were on metformin. And that work came out of South America because the guy who was trying to, forgotten his name, can't remember, who was trying to actually push it in the US was getting, you know, to parlayed off to the side. And so the metformin story rang some bells for me. So, hang on, metformin's about reducing sugar. Cancer sort of probably needs some sugar. why don't we just reduce sugar rather than having a drug? I mean, that's really simplistic sort of stuff. And then I started reading about sugar. And in my practice, like most doctors' practices, you know, we're just assaulted by this tsunami of obesity, metabolic syndrome, poor health, poor immunity, poorer outcomes than we used to have. And particularly in my practice, where I was looking after most of the diabetic foot complications in northern Tasmania, I was, you know, where I used to see the occasional patient, all of a sudden it just became this, the clinic was just being overrun. Running's a funny word to turn there, but just overwhelmed by the number of people with diabetic foot complications. And, you know, there was, I can still remember when I started to talk about sugar, I had one fellow in his 40s that he was at risk of, had him in hospital, and he was at risk of losing his limbs, his lower limbs. And ultimately, he lost one leg and part of his other foot. And I can still remember in hospital with him out of control blood glucose, blood sugar levels, and he was eating ice cream. And I said, how, you know, literally, I was just gobsmacked about, why are you eating ice cream? He said, well, they told me I can. And in fact, if you actually go through the hospital food guidelines here in Australia and you take them apart, it is recommended for people with type 2 diabetes to be having the option of having ice cream 3 times a day, plus carbs for breakfast, carbs for lunch, carbs for dinner, carbs for morning tea, carbs for afternoon tea, carbs for supper, which is a massive glucose load of which the body can't handle it. And when, most people never get to operate on people with diabetic problems and foot problems in particular. But, you know, and I have mentioned the time when, you know, when I'm operating and you've got to amputate someone's leg, it's just horrible. It's not a decision that's made overnight. It's a journey. You know, you might lose a bit of, and when you do,
typically from infection, right? Or neuropathy, you don't feel the toe, you get infection, and then there's infection in the bone, right? You wouldn't just take off the leg because someone has diabetes, right? There's this.
No. It's because of the long-term complications. And, you know, I describe those, the microvascular disease is where every single vessel becomes narrowed. Every single bit of tissue loses its oxygen supply or has a diminished oxygen supply. The nerves aren't working properly, so they can't feel it properly. And then all of a sudden you get a little crack in the skin or you stub your toe and some bugs get into that. And A, they don't feel it. B, their ability to heal it is diminished dramatically. And then it starts setting off. And they've often got diets which are spiking their blood glucoses all over the place. Their diets are often low in protein. They're often low in micronutrients. They don't get healthy fats in. And all of a sudden, it's this ongoing slow degradation process. But the same process happening in the foot is happening in the kidneys. It's happening in the eyes. It's happening in the brain. Yeah. And
some people think that that's either uncommon or it's folks who don't follow medical advice. And I had someone recently who follows medical advice, eats basically a lot of carbs and on medicine, had toe amputation, you know, the A1C was 8, and basically our best medical care guy, and he got a toe amputation, two toes. So these weren't just kind of, you know, homeless people with diabetes. These were people who were getting the best medical care we have, right?
Well, that's again the definition thing. So therefore, the medical profession tell the patients, oh, their HbA1c is, it's 7, or it's 7.5, or it's 8, oh, you've got good control. Well, that's complete nonsense. They do not have good control. Yeah, we know, and HbA1c is a measure of blood glucose control over the previous few months based on the glycation of the red blood cells in the body, but it's called the HbA1c. You know, as you know, and you're diagnosed at a HbA1c of 6.5 that you've got diabetes. Well, you know, I sort of jokingly say, what happens at 6.499? You know, you don't have diabetes. But what's interesting is that the complications of diabetes, the microvascular, the cardiovascular disease, the strokes, go up above a HbA1c of 5.7.
Yeah.
So 5.7 is not he wouldn't even be called, he wouldn't have diabetes. So how do blood glucose, having HbA1c of 7 to me is not control at all. Having HbA1c of 6.5 is not control. 6 isn't control. You want a HbA1c of 5.7 or less. So now, that's what we should be aiming for.
Can we unpack a little bit? So you're an orthopedic, going back in time, you're an orthopedic surgeon. Well, why would you take off someone's toe or someone's leg?
Because they're failing. So these people are having daily dressings. They're coming along, they've got low-grade infection, and then it becomes a greater infection. Antibiotics are given, but antibiotics can't reach it because of the blood supply issues. Doesn't matter how many supplies you've got. If you don't have a transport system to get to the destination, it doesn't matter. So antibiotics are poorly effective. I tried prescribing, literally for my patients to be given cheese and eggs in hospital. I had to write it on the chart just so they got protein. But when the infection gets out of control, then it starts ascending. So instead of being the toe, it becoming the front of the foot. It's not the front of the foot, it's the back of the foot. It's not the back of the foot, it's up to the calf. And if it's not, if you don't control the calf, then it's at the thigh, and then you die. That's the
cascade of events and leading to blood infection, sepsis, can kill you. So basically,
not can kill you, it does.
If you're saving.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Saving the life of someone by taking off their toe or their leg. That's a brilliant. You saved lives. Why weren't you satisfied?
I think we prolong them. And that's just it. But because once you have a leg amputation, your average, your life expectancy is less than 2 years. An amputation for diabetic foot, diabetic foot or diabetic leg amputation, your average life expectancy is less than 2 years. So therefore, it's palliative.
The disease has progressed that far.
Yeah, it's not just in the foot.
Yeah.
But here's a quick analogy for you, because we all like eating it, and it's really, I think, very descriptive for diabetes. It's called the Maillard reaction, M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D. Everyone knows it. It's the browning of food. So you can, every time you go to a bakehouse, you can see that tan brown color on the top of your bread or the cakes and the croissants and whatever. But essentially that's diabetes. And what I'm talking about is that what happens when you're cooking food is that under the effect of heat, the protein combines with the glucose, the glycation of the protein, and that creates the browning. And that's a fairly simplistic way of looking at it, but it's the caramelization of food. Now, what exactly the same process happens in the body. When your blood glucose goes up, your tissue glucose, because of osmotic pressure, goes up by about 2/3 to 3/4 of what it is in the blood. And under the effect of body heat, that glucose in the tissue combines with the protein in the tissue and you get the Maillard reaction. So every time your blood glucose spikes above normal, every time you are effectively toasting every single tissue in your body. And it doesn't matter. It could be your eyes, your kidneys, your feet, your vessels, your brain. Every single corner of the body is affected by the Maillard reaction. And I've pointed that out to endocrinologists and they've gone, oh, hadn't thought about it like that. And I said, well, start thinking about it like that and start describing it like that. Because until you get blood glucose control and a steady state, then you have got no chance of turning this person's diabetes around and certainly no chance of turning their complications around.
I'm just really fascinated. What was it? You were working hard. You were prolonging life, if not saving lives at that. What made you change?
I was losing. I mean, where I've got one patient 1 week, now I've got 10 the next, then you've got 100. It's just...
But you were making money.
No. There's very little money in diabetic foot management. And if you actually go to orthopedic meetings, foot and ankle orthopedic meetings, 95% of the meeting, in fact, more than that, is about doing all those fancy operations where you do make money. And most people don't. When you go to an, I used to say, can we have a session on diabetic foot management? And this is what I'm doing in the public service. But there's no money. There's literally no money in it because you're seeing patients, a lot of wounds, and I don't know what the prices are in the US, but what fees are. But there's not a lot of money in nibbling away on bits of toes and flesh. So it's not a profiteering racket. But but there is a massive cost involved in diabetes, not just in leg amputations, but the cost to the patient, their family, the workforce, the wider society is massive. It's hundreds of billions of dollars. And if we're not winning with our dietary, and so, part of it was, I said, the guidelines were you have to give all these carbs to people. I said, well, no, it's making them worse. So one of the challenges that was thrown down to me early on, I said, well, Dr. Fitke, if you've got a problem with it, you have to change the guidelines from Tasmania. And we can go on to the fact that, yes, we, up yours, okay, we're going to do it. So, in the last couple of years, but just in the last few months, we've had some massive wins. We, not just me, but we have changed the guidelines. And that was one of our endpoints, is that Linda and I have often spoken about the endpoint. The endpoint is when we can have low carb seen as an acceptable option for those people that wish to do it, and that they are supported in the management of low carb in their health, well-being, but particularly in type 2 diabetes. We've gotten to that goalpost. We've done that. So if somewhere, and you can go to a restaurant, particularly around here in Tasmania, and people say, oh, look, I'd like a low carb option. And you're not looked at as though you're from a different planet. We've now got it across the line. Here in Australia, you can buy low carb beer. Now, there's several brands. So in Australia, beer drinking, country in the world, you can buy low carb beer. You can buy low carb cookbooks at the standard stores. So low carb keto cookbooks. So, and I know you've been on this journey for longer than me, but that's a win, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's taken some time. Now, but some of the...
And a few gray hairs from us both, too.
Yeah. Some of the soldiers in this army have been embattled. For those who are just learning about you now, and what's great is new people are coming in all the time, learning about it. I remember you were in some hot water back there.
I'm sick and tired of amputating limbs. We talked about this. There's a horrible noise that when you've got someone's leg in your arm, in your hand, and you've got to drop it into a metal bin for disposal. Clunk. I can still feel it. I couldn't keep doing it. So I had to go and look at the root cause. The root cause to me was, okay, it's our nutrition, it's our diet. In particular, it's the massive amount of sugar and carbohydrate. I started talking about sugar, started lecturing it. I was invited to do a medical grand round at the hospital, which, surgeons, as you say, don't get asked to do medical grand rounds and do the presentation. And I talk...
That's unusual.
It's unusual, but, we're both unusual characters and stubborn as. But they were interested. But then I started challenging the system. I said, okay, I'd like my patients to not be given, in raw terms, a low-carb option. Stop giving them so much sugar. Give them some protein for breakfast. I want an egg on... And I actually used to write it on chart. I'd prescribe an egg because I couldn't get it through the hospital. So I'd prescribe a piece of cheese. This is ridiculous. I'm prescribing a full-fat yogurt rather than the sugar-filled yogurt. That were the three radical changes I wanted to do in the hospital. Anyway, as it turned out, that was upsetting the dietitians because that was their turf. And I also got on this thing called social media. And I can still remember Belinda and our daughter putting me on social media in the crossover in San Francisco. I still remember the table, actually. We saw it again a few years later. I said, that's the table where you ruined my life. Anyway, we had, so within 48 hours of being on social media, I was targeted by someone who was working for Coca-Cola at the time. Within months of me taking it on with the hospital system, the dietitians started taking it up with their parent body and they wanted me to be silenced about it. As it turned out, I ended up being reported to the medical board on three occasions for giving inappropriate advice outside of my clinical scope. One of those times, I got reported involved inappropriately reversing someone's type 2 diabetes on national TV. It was inappropriate that I was doing that. And, you know, okay, he only lost, you know, 30 pounds, you know, 15 kilos. He only came off six medications in 12 weeks. It was and he was feeling, you know, happier and healthier, and that was incredibly dangerous. But again, it was an orthopedic surgeon talking about it. So if you're a celebrity chef or you're someone doing it, then you can be hammered down in the press. But I was an orthopedic surgeon, and my primary aim was to stop amputating limbs, and that had a certain resonance.
Yeah.
And again, in retrospect, as it turns out, and this is years of research primarily by Belinda, because I'm talking about the science. You know, we're all going down the science pathways, the biochemistry. You know, you can't fake biochemistry. It's the essence of it. It's certain, that is science. But there's this whole field of non-science out there which has determined what our guidelines are. And as it turns out, we have the internal emails, and these have been presented to Senate inquiries from the breakfast cereal industry here in Australia. Australian Breakfast Cereal Manufacturing Forum was sitting down every 3 months at a golf club talking about tactics, and the minutes said cereal sales in Australia and New Zealand are down. The concepts of low carb and paleo at the time are responsible, and these seven people are to be targeted. And I was the only Australian doctor on that list. And there was a contractual agreement between the breakfast cereal industry and the Dietitians Association. Only one contract that they ever had was to, in fact, promote and continue to promote the benefits of sugar and cereal to the Australian population. And they were the ones that were involved in the targeting. Now, as it turned out, dietitians were the ones doing the reporting to the medical board. We've got the email chain. We've got the email receipts for the money being paid. And this is not just about me. This is about, very clearly, profits are down for the breakfast cereal industry. You know, we've got them on sugar. We've got them on carbs now. Their last bastion of survival is to keep telling us about the benefits of fiber. You know, that's...
I just want to comment that when you say Belinda, that's your wife. Belinda,
my wife Belinda. So I'm getting hammered by the medical board. The same time, Tim Noakes is in South Africa, Annika Dahlquist in Sweden. We're doing PhDs on this into the research and the fact that this is scientifically based. And Tim's case was a very open case in court. Mine was a kangaroo court. It was all behind closed doors. It was just smoke and mirrors. But along the way, Belinda said, look, she's a nurse, you know, in a past life, but she said, look, forget the science. I trust that you guys are talking about the science. You know, Eric's talking about the science. This is, you know, it's established good science, not non-science, which is, if we can actually look at non-science, it sounds a lot like nonsense.
It does. And, the way you say it.
Yes. And so she started exploring all of this other stuff. She said, okay, if the science is right, why are we not being told it? And her work has just been paramount in uncovering, like I'll say, she's the world expert on the vested interest shaping dietary guidelines at an international level. So if the science is strong, how on earth, and again, it's like people have their beliefs about nutrition. And I just like to work out what hat people are wearing. So I've been involved in a lot of debates, discussions, meetings. And so Belinda, before I enter a debate against anyone, Belinda will do research into what their vested interests are and what their beliefs are. So then I know why they believe in that. Because we're not going to lose on the science. We're not going to lose on the biochemistry. We can't, because it's just so obvious once you start working it out. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you look at the clinical situations where people improve, well, you put a glucose monitor on someone's arm with diabetes, and I've got, you know, on my phone at the moment, I'm monitoring two politicians. So I've got CGMs on them, and I'm monitoring, and they're both flatlining.
You're monitoring their their blood sugars,
no,
not their
They're monitoring their activity. Blood glucose. I don't have surveillance cameras on them, okay. No, but I'm literally just monitoring their blood glucose. And, you know, one of the, so again, this is educating the politicians about it. And they go, okay, now I've got control. And so if you have a belief, then I'd like to know how you got that belief, because we've been brainwashed that the dietary guidelines, you know, and the US dietary guidelines form the template for what most Western societies, developing nations in the world, utilize. So if the guidelines are wrong, why are they wrong? Because they're not based on science. So we can go back to the food pyramid, which was written by the American agricultural industry in the 1970s, wasn't based on science. And Zoe Harcum's done all the work on that to actually show that the, you know, what papers they used. And the McGovern report, which was changed. But Belinda's gone further back in time. And there's two time frames. One is the temperance movement in the mid-19th century, and the other one's October 23, 1917. And I think it's critical for everyone to know that, because if, back in history are the origins of our beliefs now, and I call it generational education. So if you believe your teachers and their teachers believe their teachers, and if you keep repeating something over and over and over and over again, and there are consequences if you challenge that, then we keep repeating them. You know, and you've got emails from me at the bottom. It says science evolves by being challenged, not by being followed. That is the scientific method. We're all told that that's the scientific method. But it's in nutrition, I've found that virtually everything we've been told is the truth is a house of cards. You just poke it and it falls over. Whether or not every single corner just virtually falls over. So how did we get to this belief? So long and short, October 23, 1917 was the formation of the American Dietetics Association. It started primarily with the work by a woman by the name of Lena Cooper, who was the first dietitian for the American Defense Department. She wrote the textbooks for the next 30 to 40 years of dietetics, which then got extrapolated with the textbooks for the world. But her conflict of interest was that she'd been working with John Harvey Kellogg, and his protege, and the breakfast cereal industry, and here's a little fact for you. Belinda only found it out recently. I think I'm allowed to tell. But at the very first meeting in 1917, with only a few weeks' notice, there were six processed food industry companies at that meeting advertising. At the very first one. And then that's continued on. So we can look at nutrition reviews, which was started by the food industry and, you know, the finance. We can look at Harvard T.C. Chan School of Public Health. You know, all of these schools are heavily funded by the food industry to look at the science. And if you go back over time, I get it that the food industry were trying to make their food more palatable. That's called the bliss point, you know, get the right amount of fat and sugar in it. They were looking at making their product have greater shelf life.
It's good business.
It was called profit. You know, and trying to find all those points had a lot of science involved in it. They had laboratories, they did experiments on, you know, with food and the genetically modified foods.
I learned a lot from Belinda's work and looking back, the religious.
I'll come to that, but just finish that last bit. But what somewhere in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, we started believing that the nutrition science was medical science and it was given the same weight. And it's not. It was actually about profitability for the food industry. It had nothing to do with health outcomes for the population. And it just got this crossover, this grace, which became generational education. You know, salt's bad, carbs are good, fat's bad, cholesterol bad, eggs good, bad. It's not based on science. It was based about profit. So that's the profitability aspect of our nutritional education, and how the textbooks were written pretty well by the breakfast cereal industry right from the outset. But again, if you've got to go back in history to work out why they believed that. Why was breakfast cereal invented? And some people find this a bit challenging, but John Harvey Kellogg invented breakfast cereal to stop everyone from masturbating because
reduce the male libido.
Well, no. Well, both male and female. So his work at the Battle Creek, Michigan, he was the modern day hospital is a result of John Harvey Kellogg. The Battle Creek, Michigan, you know, that structure which we're all part of in Western society, big buildings, multiple levels, multiple specialties coming together into the one space and having this sort of vertical and horizontal integration is a concept started by John Harvey Kellogg. He was brilliant. He had multiple food patents. Over 100 patents. But what we do owe him is we do owe him the current hospital system that we have. But he had these weird thoughts, which were driven by his upbringing as a Seventh-day Adventist. And we can excuse him for it when you actually go back in time. So he believed that the vilest sin was masturbation, and if you masturbated, you were not going to go to heaven. If you don't go to heaven, then you don't get to have eternal life. Now, this is a primary concept of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But how did John Harvey Kellogg was SDA, but when he was at the age of 12, he went to work for the First Family. So we're now back in the middle 1800s, so temperance movement times. And Ellen G. White, who was the prophetess, was her first book, we can quote the exact name, was about the perils of masturbation in children. Now, that book was typeset by John Harvey Kellogg as a 12-year-old. So he was working for the First Family of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He was taken in by them as a protege. As a 12-year-old, he's typesetting this learning, complete brainwashed at such an early age. And this is an important bit of history because we're paying the consequences here now. So as a 12-year-old, he was brainwashed into believing the visions of Ellen G. White were true and that you could not masturbate. Now, he ended up, I think, adopting multiple children, but apparently didn't consummate his marriage. So again, he had, well, I think, 10...
He was eating too many cornflakes.
Well, remember,
this is the Kellogg that we see in the grocery store. Same name.
The same. But he was, as part of all that at Battle Creek, Michigan. Now, it was about having fresh air and exercise, but it was also about having lots of water enemas. It was about circumcising males and clitoral ablation with acid for young girls. And it was all about purity. And
there was a movie, Road to Wellville, that was a spoof. Yes. Was that relatively accurate?
It was a spoof movie, but it actually was pretty accurate as far as
there were all sorts of weird things like the enemas and the electricity and it's a fascinating movie for the history, I think.
But again, it comes back to these beliefs. So again, back in the temperance movement times, there was a time when people were moving there wasn't enough work in the bush, so they were moving to the cities. The men would move to the cities. There was poor sanitation, so therefore the water wasn't good, so therefore there was drinking of a low-alcohol food, the mead, the low-alcohol beer. So as a result of that beer, everyone was I'm time-traveling. I'm creating a picture where people were slightly drunk. Their libido was in action. There was infidelity. And the temperance movement at that time was going, hang on, we need to clean our acts up here. Stop drinking alcohol. Let's go for pure living, pure food. But at the same time, meat, they couldn't get fresh meat into the city. So what meat that had been produced on the land was being salted to try and bring it into the city, and the salt didn't work fully. So all of a sudden we've got a demonization of meat because it's putrid, but we started having this thought that there's a demonization of salt as well. It's got nothing to do with salt being bad. It just happened to be that it wasn't quite good enough for preserving the meat. We've got this thing called refrigeration now. But we try and go back in history to try and work out why do we believe that fat's bad? Why do we believe that meat's bad? Why do we believe that salt's bad? So Ellen G. White, her prophecies were not, first of all, masturbation will stop you from going to heaven. But she started going, meat causes violence. Meat causes masturbation. meat causes cancer. And we don't know really whether or not she was talking about cancer of the soul or cancer. But guess what? Over time, we've had meat causes cancer, meat causes violence, meat causes, all these animalistic attitudes. Meat is bad. So, that's why the Seventh-day Adventist is promoting veganism. They effectively, and people say, like, why are you going on about the Seventh-day Adventist Church? I said, well, incredibly powerful. Most people do not realize that they started this breakfast cereal industry of the world. They started the alternate meat industry of the world. They are the vegan propaganda machine at this point in time. They start the soy industry.
I just had this thought that it's kind of like the religious people who are trying to find evidence that Jesus was the Son of God, or trying to, in the history, you're always trying to find, so that they already knew red meat was bad by prophecy, and so now the scientists are using really weak science, the nutritional epidemiology, observational studies, and they take this, it's almost like they're just trying to prove what they already know to be true, but what they believe, when you really can't, science isn't going to support that belief.
Here's even more history for you. A fellow by the name of Harry China Miller, he's called China because he did a lot of work in China with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And so he effectively brought this soy back to the US. And the whole Western soy industry is pretty well started and offered, by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. His main claim, lots of things that he got up to, but one was actually to create the infant soy formula, to get that through all the US regulations. So the infant soy formula, we look up Harry China Miller. So he's the instigator. But when he came back to the US, he set up research laboratories as Seventh-day Adventist to prove the visions of Ellen G. White from the 1860s and 70s. So literally, we've got the document. Literally, his research was to prove the visions of Ellen G. White. And out of that started rolling the Adventist health studies, of which get regularly quoted as being proof that vegetarian veganism actually is beneficial. And they only did four studies, but they recite each other and they cite them over and over and over. So they become incredible.
Well, and the comparative group is the typical American diet, which is pretty easy to beat for health.
Well, it is, but what's interesting is the definitions of vegetarianism and veganism used by the Adventist health studies. So you're vegetarian if you don't eat, if you eat meat less than once a week.
I don't know.
And you're vegan if you eat meat less than once a month.
I mean, you can have meat and still...
You can have meat there. So this, in the Adventist health studies, which are quoted as the biblical proof that vegetarian veganism works, you can still have meat. Now, Ellen G. White apparently was still having meat and animal-based product, eggs and cheese, into her late 80s.
Interesting.
So you're promoting one thing. Have we heard this before in any fabulous society? You promote one thing, but you're doing another? Yeah. And so, but the trouble is, as Belinda sort of, as she said, she's not anti-religious. She used to be a Sunday school teacher. We're not anti-religion. It's just that this group is the soy industry, this breakfast cereal industry, the alternate meat industry has its origins there. They, in fact, own the stevia industry for a long time. They've vertically integrated themselves into our educational system, and they've had a message of, and this is called definition of propaganda. I think I know we caught up with you at CrossFit in 2017, something like that. And prior to that, we'd done a tour of propaganda. It was our pilgrimage of propaganda. Well, if you think about propaganda, and you can apply this across the whole spectrum of ideas, you have a message of fear, you repeat it, you control the media, and you add theatre to it. And so you think about all the great propagation, whether or not you're talking about the church, talking about the Catholic Church for 1,000 years, you're talking about the Nazi Germany. I think that we were doing this. We were looking at, look at cathedrals. Cathedrals that, you cannot, I actually time people. I stand inside a cathedral and I time people when they walk in the door before they look up in awe. And it's only seconds. And that's churches actually areas of propaganda. You have your control, you have a message of fear. Do what we'd say, otherwise you're going to go to hell and that's going to be horrible. And they had control the message, they repeat it over and over and over. And there's theatre. So, you know, the priest or minister will stand up there, but it's generally a morning light that will be shining through stained glass and it'll be on top of the people. It's theatre. The Nazis did it. And guess what? The food industry continued to do the same thing. They have a message of fear.
Fear and doubt.
And so, you know, the breakfast cereal, you know, Walt Disney, for instance, he got his start in life for doing breakfast cereal from cartoons. So
it makes sense. Well, but what's fascinating is this all started by someone telling you that you should change the guideline. And so you listen to the basis of guidelines were not scientific. Now I want a happy ending, please, where you've actually made some headway.
18 months ago, I gave a lecture to, couple of years ago, one of the good things about COVID is that, I'm not going to be too specific, but you couldn't travel. So meetings were done by Zoom.
Right.
So there were people involved in meetings that I was not allowed to be in, but they could turn their camera off and mute their video microphone, and they could make a phone call to me in the midst of these big meetings. And I'd say, okay, we'd say, oh, they've got a vested interest here. Why don't you say this? Why don't you say that? Anyway, I've got effectively the low carbohydrate living or therapeutic carbohydrate restriction is ability to put type 2 diabetes into remission. That is part of the national diabetes strategy. Had to be fought tooth and nail. So they've got bariatric surgery, they've got very low calorie drinks and low carb are methods of putting type 2 diabetes into remission. So it's the first time ever in the world where the option or the existence of the word remission actually exists in a diabetes document. That's critical because that's all we've been saying. You have the option. You've made a lifestyle decision to get diabetes. You might have done it inadvertently. You can take a lifestyle option to get rid of it. You don't have to take more and more drugs. It does not have to be chronic and progressive. Anyway, so 18 months ago, I ended up giving a lecture. I was asked to, you know, play good cop, bad cop. And I gave a talk on how to manage diabetes to about 40, including several professors. You can imagine how that went down.
So you're an orthopedic surgeon.
What the? It was. And James Mukey, to his credit, he asked me to come along and give that talk. He was Australian of the Year in 2020. So I gave that presentation and James was shouting from the floor. I was called all sorts of things. It was a Zoom meeting. Again, people could Zoom in. Belinda watched it by Zoom. She actually gave me a gold star for being on my best behavior. The great thing about when I was being abused from the floor by these professors, the camera was on me. So I was able to roll my eyes at the questions coming in because all I did was stick to the science. Here's the biochemistry. You can have your opinion, but here's the biochemistry. Just tell me. And it, essentially, as you know, diabetes is an inability to control the blood glucose that you eat. All the medications we give are to do something with the blood glucose you eat. And you either don't absorb it, you pee it out, or you push it into your tissues in varying degrees. But if you don't eat it, you don't need the medication. So you don't need endocrinologists. I've just cut a lecture down to not much. Anyway, within a couple of days, defamation lawyers were involved about what was being said about me at the university. I don't mind saying it. I called the dean of the medicine out there for receiving a couple of $100,000 directly from the pharmaceutical industry for personal payments, not for research. I've got problems with universities receiving money from drug companies and food industries for research. But when you get tens of thousands of dollars as direct payments, then I've got a big problem. And particularly for the gatekeeper of medicine, gatekeeper of education to our students, is receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars. Anyway, I'm no longer allowed to give lectures in that state, but because I've called the dean of medicine out. But I have a big problem with it. And you know, and I don't think I'm a hothead. I think I'm a controlled head. I'm just go, no, that's wrong. You shouldn't be doing it. Anyway, despite that meeting, one of the senior endocrinologists was brave enough to send four or five of his worst patients to a dietitian who was completely on board, and she put them all into remission. A few months down the track, it's then their idea, and you've been a co-author on the Society of Metabolic Health to that working document on diabetes that Adele Height really, it was her job, but we were all, you know, both of us were co-authors. So that document became the working document.
Nice.
And so the Australian Diabetes Society has now adopted that as a statement, and the Australian Diabetes Society has now made that a working document for Diabetes Australia. These are massive wins. If you want to do low carb, it is now part of the national strategy. It is safe, it is effective, and it should be supported, and you should not be ridiculed for it. And you certainly shouldn't have your medical license threatened for it, tick. Well done, Eric. You and I are part of that team. And
yeah, well, but thank you for slogging it out. I mean, and you were selected out to be a surgeon, which in and of itself, the training is much harder than internal medicine. So, and maybe even a challenge to keep it going. But thank you for that. And so now, our job's done, huh?
Well, no, I've got the next job for us, okay? But,
please.
I've always asked my patients, I said, do you smoke? You know, it's part of taking a general history. Do you smoke? And they'll go, yes. So rather than ask them how many, I always used to say, well, why? Why do you smoke?
Yeah.
I said, well, most of the times they'll say, well, I'm an idiot. And I guess, okay, today, if you decide to smoke, you have pretty well made an informed decision to be an idiot. The next step is we need to get education, health education across the line, where if you decide to eat badly, if you want to have a high carbohydrate diet, high processed food diet, high seed oil diet, and if you want to eat a diet which is nutrient poor, energy dense, deficient in protein, you know, essential proteins, fats, micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, if you want to eat that, then I want you to make an informed decision that you're an idiot because you're having that slow Maillard reaction. And I think that's the next step. You know, I think we're getting there, but we don't need to be vegans. I actually don't mind vegan people because they're on that journey. They're trying to do the right thing by their health, their society. They've just fallen for the propaganda, which we can trace most of that problem back to origins with the Adventist Church and the food industry. So I think that's the next step. And I'll use by way of an example is our daughter was 16 at the time. She was, still has, you know, long blonde hair and long legs. And she's beautiful like her mother. And we were coming off the airplane and she said, oh, Dad, can I have some Macca's chips? Because she just always had a salt craving after getting off the plane. And she said, look, I know how you hate the concept of that. And, you know, some of my side lectures, I often talk about the half-life of the inflammatory seed oils, and they're probably about 4 years in oleic acid. You know, they're on YouTube, those talks. But anyway, she looked me in the eye and she said, Dad, I promise not to get pregnant for 4 years. So she had made an informed decision that she was going to go and she wanted those chips. She made an informed decision that they were bad for her, but she wanted them that badly. But her trade-off was that she wasn't going to get pregnant for 4 years. Now, you tell me which father is not going to fork out a few dollars of coins out of his pocket if his 16-year-old daughter promises not to get pregnant for 4 years?
I'd bought her the whole pack, the whole box.
No, she didn't know. But what I'm sort of saying, she's a highly intelligent young woman. She's well past that now. She's late 20s. But she had made an informed decision. Now, that's what I'd like society to be making an informed decision. Unfortunately, we're up against this enormous machine of propaganda telling us that meat is bad, meat's now bad for the environment. It all stems back to meat is bad and causes masturbation and cancer. We've heard this story over and over and over. It's just changing. So instead of, then it was fat is bad because that was another way of getting back at meat. Unfortunately, and I know this is painting with a broad brush, this belief stems back to temperance movement ideas. And it stems back to one very powerful small group that that has been able to control itself. Now, it's fascinating how far they've come in their educational guidelines, but they've also moved into the United Nations, the World Health Organization. They've also moved into your US Senate, and you start looking at who's actually at the pulpit addressing your congressmen every Saturday and Sunday, who's in addressing your defense forces. In Polynesia, the South Pacific, I think we've got six presidents or prime ministers of their countries that are Seventh-day Adventists, who are trying to promote more breakfast cereal and grains into a community which are the fattest and the most obese and the most diabetic prone in the world. And but they believe it. And the trouble is their belief is if they believe this and they can push. And here's the origin of the vegan concept. Once we believe as a society that vegetarian veganism is the way to go, the Seventh-day Adventist community honestly believe that that's when Christ will return. That's their mission statement. So therefore, that's why this belief is so strong. They're not doing it for money. They might have tied up with the corporate food industry and the guideline. They're caught up with it, but they're doing it for belief. And that's why it's so powerful.
And you don't have to have money to believe, so you can have more people, even poor people can believe, right?
And the Adventist Church is incredibly strong in developing nations. They're spending their money. Ellen G. White's books are the most translated books by any woman in the world. And I think male as well. She's the most highly published woman in the world. But her books are published in more languages than any other author in the world. And it's about developing this.
Well, you know, our time's coming to a close. Can we talk again in the future sometime? This is great.
Well, when did we ever stop talking?
Well, so I'd like to wrap up a little bit, just some themes perhaps that diabetes, because of its cost, its human suffering, was a pivot point for you in your career, taking care of patients. I think it's also going to be a pivot point for governments like the Australian government. The U.S. Non-governmental ADA actually has low carb in there. And then the Virta Health company targeting diabetes, it seems to me that's going to be a fulcrum, a turning point where low carb gets by reversing and diabetes and saving money. Science is going to win out, I believe.
Well, whenever I meet up with the politicians, I offer them money. I say, here's something which is not going to cost you. In fact, here in Australia, I went to one of the federal politicians. I'd like to give you $50 billion every year. She had an aide present, so I said, "This is an open bribe."
So it's not like you have a suitcase of money that you're.
No. I want to give you $50 billion. Okay,
yeah.
But for want of a better term, in Australia, but you're going to have to put your balls on the line. You know, it's good. But you are going to upset, these corporate sponsors over here. But you're going to have all of this money to do stuff over there. So never, ever go to a politician and ask for money. Only ever offer them cost-neutral or cost-benefit things. But the problem, as you know, and because we're on this journey for a long time, is that the return on investment on preventative health is longer than one electoral term.
Right.
So therefore, that's why I put these CGMs on, these glucose monitors, because you can get an immediate effect and improvement in outcome within a week. So well under one electoral term. I say, look, it's a glucose monitor. I don't know what they cost in the US. They're completely overpriced. They're $100 here. But I say, well, let's put them on every single person with type 2 diabetes in the hospital. Because if you have your blood glucose tested with a pinprick in the finger, that takes time for the nurse to do it, record it. So you can easily make up the cost of the monitor within a day or two, and you get infinitely better control. And we will show overnight how bad hospital food is and how it needs to have less carb, better protein. And we can immediately
Do you need a doctor's prescription to get a CGM in Australia?
No.
In the US, you do. I mean, so I have to write prescription. And then if someone doesn't have diabetes, it's typically not covered, but you can buy it for $100 a month.
So it would, Eric, as you know, from craft testing, virtually everyone has diabetes.
If you're a carb eater, you have to qualify that, please. If you're a carb eater.
I'm going to use language carefully here because I know what's written on the websites to get hold of the CGMs. It says that you have insulin requiring diabetes. You have diabetes requiring insulin, okay? So in fact, if we actually look at it, if you eat a diet high in carbohydrates, you are technically, in my book, you have diabetes, and you are still producing insulin to control it, still at this point in time. So I actually think in the loose language that's already written, everyone's actually eligible for it.
Well, I see. The CGM, the continuous glucose monitoring, is a way to convince even the worst skeptic, and it's painless. And actually, I wore one once only because there were young doctors now wearing them and telling me all about it. But at the end of the month, I ended up having a higher blood glucose because I tested all the different things that I wish I could eat. So I went from 80 to 90 to 100 to 110 because occasionally I wanted the croissant, I wanted the, it actually made my blood sugar worse.
I did it once where I was giving a lecture to 300 people or something, and I wore a CGM and I ate two bananas in front of the audience. And my blood glucose just started climbing.
And that's a great way to... You're sacrificing yourself for science and theater.
At the end of 30 minutes or whatever, I was losing my voice. My blood glucose had doubled. I came up the back, and my daughter, who was up there, said, "Daddy, are you okay?" I said, "I feel like beep, just I feel really crook." And I had to wait for the other lecturers to finish before I could get back on the podium, and my blood glucose had come down. So I think if you are low carb over a long period of time, you are sensitized to glucose when it hits the body. And that's what happens in women who are running low carb in pregnancy when they have a glucose tolerance test. So you've got to biohack them into their glucose tolerance test, which we did with our daughter, and she passed it beautifully. But again, the systems depend, insurance companies, the guidelines are all about these paradigms of fear, which have hung around for a long time. And there are ways about biohacking around them for insurance claims and stuff like that. But more importantly, we are seeing the guidelines change now. And
that's fantastic.
That means that we're not alone. And whether or not it's science or perseverance or the cult of low carb is actually winning. It's only winning because people are actually getting better.
Right. Yeah. If given the chance, it will win. And now more and more people are giving it a chance. And thank you for going through what you had to go through to prove the authorities wrong and clamping down on you, be able to teach people. And thank you and Belinda for continuing in this fight, which, again, that's kind of the last question. Why do you keep doing this? Aren't you retired by now?
Some years ago, I read a book saying about maturity, and you can define maturity when you work out when to say no. So it's quite an important point to get through, rather than saying yes to people or no to people. So what happened to me with all of this nutrition stuff is that I had a point in time where I said, no more. No, this is all wrong, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to get it to be right. And so we've achieved a goal that we talked about 10 years ago, which is to see that if you want to do low carb, you should be supported in that journey by people around you, society, but particularly the medical profession and the authorities that are making decisions. And if it means calling out a whole lot of scams along the way, then have we reached our end point? No, but I suppose it's a bit like golf, Eric, and you and I know all about that in our one and only challenge at the first in the inaugural International North Perth and Southern Hemisphere Golf Challenge.
April 10, 2019.
It's the inaugural one. But we didn't invite Mike Eads to it, by the way. But
next time.
We'll have to.
Next time. Well, that's just to bolster your side. There is no end point, you know?
No. Yeah. That was another game, another course.
But the,
another shot.
So we will continue to do what we're doing right now, which is supporting others. So rather than lecturing to one patient at a time, I'm spending more time trying to talk to politicians, monitoring them. We're doing our podcast together. Let's change this for the bigger community. So I think that what we're doing now, or what I'm doing, I reach more people on social media or my lectures every day or every week than I will in a lifetime of medicine.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. And it's an honor for us to be able to do that, isn't it?
I don't know why else we're doing it. It's certainly not ego. Our surgeons have got enough ego as it is. I think it's just about doing the right thing. And you'd need to know my family history of what my mother and grandmother got up to in Nazi Germany to know where. And I didn't find that out until 2017. A lot of my family history. So the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree. But it's like an absolute delight catching up with you again. And
yes. Thank you. Now, how do people find you currently on social media? And
well, we're in Tasmania, so you can't find us down here. So I'm on Twitter, Gary Fedke, but Fructose, no. Our talks are on YouTube, and I encourage people. I talk more about the science. One of the times I got into trouble with the medical board was because I was making things too simple. So the whole idea is to let people understand them. I'm not making that up anyway. So my talks are on YouTube. Belinda's talks are on YouTube. I've got a website, one truly out of date, called nofructose.com. Belinda has one called I Support Gary, which was done to help get me off all the APRA stuff, which has a lot of her work on it. We're doing less on Facebook because I think there's a lot more censoring on that.
Yeah,
but we're out there. I'm so glad
you're still in the game. And for those who are watching who have never met Dr. Gary Fedke before, this has been a wonderful talk. And watch this again, because we went over a lot of information. And the first time I heard the Seventh-day Adventist thing, I thought, no, can't be. But it rings true, and it explains why so many things just don't make sense, because it's not science, it's nonsense. I like the non-science.
And the Seventh-day Adventist Church, at a very, very senior level, acknowledge Belinda's work and correspond with her. They're actually proud of what they're doing. They've published the stuff, and they've actually published her work, and they acknowledge her and the references. So it's a strange thing. They're not actually upset with her for calling it out. Actually, yeah, we're proud of this. We're trying to do it.
Yeah, yeah. That was just amazing that the Seventh-day Adventist folks are happy that Belinda's calling them out. They don't realize that you're being critical. Because they're part of a religious, anyway, it doesn't make sense.
Look, Belinda's the angel. She's sorted. I think she's going to go to heaven. I think I'm the one who might be heading in the other direction. So,
well, and you know that where the Kellogg cornflake came from, and then of course the post and cornflake said that I've heard that too, and I'm kind of in disbelief, but. I think I'm going to go have some red meat.
Bacon and eggs for us here. It's evening for you. It's morning here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Until the next time.
Good go, bye-bye.
Tell you what, I'm going to say let's stop there. And then thanks so much. I'm looking here because now I'm seeing you. And really, I hope you're doing all right health-wise. And thanks to both of you.
Well, you'll be aware of those life stress scores, that when you said. And if you score more than 200 points, then you're likely to come down with something. Well, Belinda and I have worked out, I got her to do them. I actually got the kids to do them as well. And so she was flapping along at 500 plus for several years.
Yeah.
So she was just a sitter. I'm somewhat fortunate. I've got Addison's. So
I didn't know.
No, it's fabulous, actually. John F. Kennedy had it. A few other people have had it. the great thing about, and we're in the midst of one of the Senate inquiries, and Belinda looked across at me. She said, why aren't you completely knackered? And then she found out, a few minutes later, I think she went out of the car and she was waiting to go in, and she just found me giggling in the car. And she said, what are you giggling? You completely lost the plot. And I said, no, I've got an X-Man superpower. She said, then she thought I'd definitely lost the plot. And I said, no, I've got Addison's. So the great thing about Addison's is that I can be stressed here in the head.
You're not stressed.
I don't get the physical manifestations of the hypercortisolemia. So every day, if I work out how much dexamethasone I need to have based on how much mental stress I'm going to have, not physical stress. And so the moment she realized that they can't hurt me.
Well, maybe you need to be a politician.
It has been discussed. Actually, Belinda was approached to go into politics here. And she considered for a little bit. Then she just looked at me one day. She said, I don't want to spend time with people I don't like. And that was it. Just drew a line, said no.
Yeah.
Like she was going to be supported. We've got an upper and lower house here, and the upper house is relatively apolitical, and she's well known for being lovely and unbiased and yet strong. So the retiring member, who was an independent, approached her, but the other two independent members on either electorate, either side, were all, you know, very highly supportive of her doing it. So she had a good chance of actually getting in with every sitting member around her giving her support. But she just looked at me one day and said, no, don't want to do that. Which is that maturity thing. No.
Life's too short. Yeah, but that's a blessing to be able to choose. I'm still, 4 days in a clinic. Yeah, I can't choose who comes in to see me.
But on the whole, it's still enjoyable. I did retire from clinical. I've got a new scar across here. I had some more surgery on the pituitary a couple of years ago, and then it got complicated by a frontal bleed, and I had double vision for 6 months. So my first world problem is that. And I've complained to my neurosurgeon is that I have trouble reading the slope on a golf green. It was enough to take the edge off surgery. So I had a little bit more damage to the optic nerve, but I literally just, like, I'd be able to read or make a cut with bone within a degree or two. So this needs to be at 35 degrees, and I'll make the cut just with my eye. 45 degrees or 135 degrees or 90 degrees. Because bones are all curved, so therefore, and I was able to eyeball that. And I've lost that. I've lost that accuracy. So it was my own decision. Also, the medical board, if I had it further after having, so they want my guts for gartet. If I made one mistake or one error, they would come after. So a lot of work I'm still doing is against the medical board. Against it. I'd like to see that our medical regulators burnt to the ground so Phoenix can rise out of the ashes. We also did a fair amount of work here, which you'll be unaware of. We had a pedophile active on our children's ward, a male nurse, for 18 years.
No way.
And he was being reported to the medical administration that they weren't doing anything about it. Same medical administration, the guy in charge there, was the one fabricating all the stuff about me. So in the same time frame that he's fabricating 800 pages of stuff about me, he's not actually looking at a pedophile. Do you know how many doctors in our community stood up and screamed about that?
None. You.
And so ultimately, again, because I get along quite well with the politicians, I'm apolitical, I keep coming to them with, I never complain to them. I said, look, here's some solutions for you to think about. I was able to get on the phone one weekend and have a chat to a couple of them. They then raised it in Parliament on the Monday, hammered the health minister, and within a couple of days we had an inquiry going into that and then into the youth detention centre and the education system. It turned into a full-blown commission. Forget our low-carb stuff, which is huge on a bigger thing, but in our local community, I've actually been able to burn the hospital administration to the ground. So the entire admin's gone. Sounds have I got a nasty streak in me? Yes. You bastards did this to me, but more importantly, they stopped the low carb message and all those people have had complications for 10 more years than they could have. Because I was saying, we could do something. We could be the leaders here. So, and so, you know, that took up a fair amount of energy as well. But
wow.
So, but you know, your program today was definitely not about pedophiles active in the children's ward. And it's
what cut that?
Yeah, it's not being recorded. What I'm sort of saying is our belief is still in doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, amen. Keep up.
Keep well, kind sir.
Have a wonderful day.
I just remembered something that someone I was supposed to ring back last night, and I didn't. Wait.
Take care.
Keep well, man. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed this video, be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell. And check out AdapterLifeAcademy.com.